Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Okay, so welcome everybody to another episode of Behind the Knife. We're absolutely thrilled to have Dr. Timothy Eberline, who is the Bixby Professor and Chairman of the Department of Surgery at Washington University in St. Louis. He also serves as the Surgeon in Chief at Barnes Jewish Hospital, and he's also the Olin Distinguished Professor and Director of the Alvin J. Siteman Cancer Center at Barnes Jewish Hospital and Washington University School of Medicine. He's also the Editor-in-Chief of Journal of the American College of Surgeons, and I'm just going to stop there. I could go on and on, sir, and we wouldn't have an opportunity to talk. Welcome to Behind the Knife.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So, for the listeners that are unaware, could you tell us a little bit about your background, a little bit more along the lines of kind of where you're from, where'd you train, kind of how you got into medicine, how you got into surgery a little bit?
Sure. I grew up in western Pennsylvania and had actually very little exposure to medicine other than visiting my pediatrician intermittently. And during undergraduate, as Western Pennsylvania economically was being stressed, steel mills were closing, things like that, I had an opportunity to do a summer job in Washington, D.C., and I actually worked in a VA hospital. And I worked in sterile supply. I actually sterilized OR instruments and the OR packs that all of us are very familiar with. And at the end of the summer, one of the supervisors who had taken me under her wing said that the Georgetown medical students were going home for the summer, and would I be interested in volunteering? I wouldn't be paid, but volunteer to hold retractors in the operating room, and I would actually get to see real patients and real surgeons. I said, gee, that sounded like it would be an interesting thing to do, having no exposure to surgery. And I walked in an operating room and for the first time, and I said, gee, that's what I'm going to do the rest of my life. And that's, I put on blinders after that and you know, applied to medical school, through medical school, thinking about the surgical training and residency and so on. So, but that's, it was really this serendipitous intervention during a summer job that actually got me into surgery.
Tell us a little bit about where you trained and kind of how it came to the point, your first few jobs before ultimately you wound up at WashU.
Well, sure. I basically worked in the surgical laboratories at the University of Pittsburgh. I went to undergraduate and to medical school at the University of Pittsburgh, and actually the very next summer in Pittsburgh, still as an undergraduate, is when I started to work in the labs, and so I got to do dog surgery and pig surgery and put in vascular anastomoses. We were doing some of the very first studies with vascular prosthetic material and Gore-Tex and so on. And same way, we actually, Mark Ravitch came back from Russia and brought staplers, and we were actually doing stapled anastomoses in dog lab and the pigs, and using the staplers that were among the very first in the United States. And so, needless to say, I got a lot of experience technically, but I also was able to write a number of papers and what have you, and so that continued all the way through medical school. And I was very, very fortunate that I was accepted to the Brigham. It was actually the Peter Bent Brigham at that time. And partway through my residency, I decided to do immunology and immune therapy research, and I did that at the National Cancer Institute with Steve Rosenberg, and went back to the Brigham and was asked to join the faculty, and I was there as the vice chair of the department and the Wilson professor before I moved to St. Louis.
Now, Dr. Eberlein, John McClellan here. You know, I want to jump a few years forward now and talk about your role as editor of JAX. You know, I just want to talk about, maybe you can give us your perspective on the journal's evolution from, you know, a decade or two ago to present day, and where do you see it going in the near future?
Sure. You know, the Journal of the American College of Surgeons started out as SG&O over 100 years ago, and I was very fortunate to follow in Cy Schwartz's footsteps and was asked to become the editor-in-chief. And at the time I took over, the college had just begun the supervision of the and copyright ownership of the journal. And it was our idea that we could take advantage of the readership of the American College of Surgeons and improve the impact factor of the journal. And in fact, I think over the last decade or so, that's exactly what has happened. There are a number of unique components with the college that we take advantage of. It, you know, the journal is distributed to some 70,000 surgeons throughout the United States and Canada. We're able to highlight articles that have been published or will be published through the communications division of the American College of Surgeons. And so it's not uncommon for high-impact papers to be picked up by the Wall Street Journal and other lay but very reputable communication devices. And then we actually spent a great deal of time thinking through how we could make the journal's process more efficient. And so we actually are the very first large Elsevier journal to become completely electronic through the submission process. That's obviously now very common, but we were actually among the first. And over the years, we've cut down the process time. So you submit an article, and usually within about 2 or 2.5 weeks, we can give you a decision. And once the paper is accepted, within about a week of some of the background checking and proofing and so on, it is posted on our website, and it would be a fully citable paper. And so in some cases, those papers that are accepted fairly easily with minor revision, that whole process can take less than a month. And so it's a vehicle for rapid communication of high-impact publications. And over the last decade plus, the impact factor has risen dramatically. As one measure of the utility of the journal, but I think even more impressive is the number of downloads and page visits that we get, and that's now in the millions and still growing significantly. And so it's been very, very helpful. We've become the official publication of the Southern Surgical Association and the Western Surgical Association, and now the New England Surgical Association. So a lot has happened over the last decade.
So I would be amiss not to give you a big thanks for plugging Behind the Knife on your with a direct link on the journal's website. So thank you very much for that. A real quick question. You talk a lot about impact factor, and I know as the world kind of transitions to other things and other way that people get media, including podcasts, do you have any thoughts about altmetrics and, you know, the tracking? I know you guys do it with your journal, and talking about the engagement of social media and maybe how often it's talked about, how many tweets it gets, how many times that people are talking about it on Reddit or something like that. Is this a real thing? Do you foresee a day when it won't be about the impact factor, it'll be about some combined factor or maybe the altmetrics?
Well, that's actually a really good point. I personally think that we are just at the threshold of changing the journal and the whole paradigm of scientific publishing, and we've really have to take advantage of the electronic digital formatting. I have said to my fellow regents of the college and leadership of the college that I believe that I think within the next couple of years we probably will not have a print journal, and so yes, we've hired an associate editor for social media, and Lillian Cowell has done a phenomenal job of supervising our tweeting about articles, et cetera, et cetera. And you're absolutely correct. I mean, we don't think of altmetrics as a measure of how an article is read and reviewed, but those kind of alternative metrics that are picked up are very, very powerful. You can actually have millions of viewers when they're picked up and tweeted, and other individuals tweet information, and it's an incredibly powerful mechanism. And I think scientific journals, particularly surgical scientific journals, are just getting into that. And again, I'd like to think that Jax is on the leading edge. We've been very fortunate. Elsevier has been quite supportive. And I think Dave Hoyt and the leadership of the American College of Surgeons has been extraordinarily helpful in helping us to adapt to this new digital format, and with the idea that we'll be eliminating all of the print very certainly.
Sir, yeah, we've actually been lucky enough to have Dr. Lillian Cowell on Behind the Knife a couple of times, and she has been fantastic. So thank you for letting her join us there.
She is phenomenal. I can't say enough good things about her. We actually presented to the American Board of American College of Surgeons Board of Regents, I think they were blown away by the power of social media and the ability to attract attention to high-impact articles in the journal. And again, those are all rules that most of us as surgeons don't think about, but I think this will be very important, particularly to younger members of the American College of Surgeons, and certainly to our trainees. That all of my trainees, I say I don't think any of them would even know the color of our journal, but you know, they all have things on their iPhone, and you know, it's electronic, and that digital access is instantaneous, and that's, you know, that providing information to surgeons and trainees alike in that almost instantaneous format is much more useful to them than the old days of walking into your office and picking out a journal and trying to look something up.
Yeah. We're actually, as part of our podcast, we've been featuring different journal articles where we actually call the author and discuss the kind of why they did the study, the pertinent findings, and how this will affect practice. And that way people on their way to work can just kind of get an update on some of the late breaking journal articles. So that's been a lot of fun. But sir, speaking of trainees, you're at one of the most prestigious programs, and you're the chair of surgery in the country. And the question we have is, a lot of med students are interviewing right now. The fellows just found out where they're matched. What do you look for when you're interviewing med students and residents that are applying for fellowships? What are the factors that define med students and residents from different from other residents?
Well, we're very, very fortunate in that I think we have the best residents in the United States. I always joke that I'm glad I'm not applying, because my application would probably never have been reviewed. But it's a very good question, and one that I've not seen a very good objective answer to say what makes a really great resident. And we can sit here and say, well, they all have great board scores, or they had great evaluations and grades in medical school, and their letters of recommendation are great, and so on. And in our program, we get about 1,000 applications, and so, as you can imagine, by the time we whittle down to the people that we interview, virtually everybody is of the caliber that, you know, their grades are good, their recommendations are good, their board scores are good, their in-training exam scores are good, etc. How do you split the hairs? And a lot of the time I say it is who really wants to be here. And I mean that from the perspective that our program has embraced flexibility in training and early specialization and other criteria, and we're a big proponent of trainees train at different rates and have different areas of passion, and so allowing each individual trainee to do what they want to do is something that's very important. And so the people who want to be here and take advantage of those opportunities, whether it's to obtain a master's in population health science, to obtain an MBA, to get a master's in clinical investigation, to do basic science research, to do clinical studies. We have a very large centralized clinical investigation group that sort of takes a page out of the cancer center's infrastructure. Whether you want to do outcomes research, et cetera, is all those opportunities are available, and will you want to come here and take advantage of that? So that's sort of the way, and I have to say even some of my own faculty don't necessarily agree with that, but I think that people who really want to be here in order to take advantage of some component of our training program that fulfills their unique and specific expectations for training.
Okay, now it's time for our dissection of the day, and we're going to talk a little bit about something that you just mentioned, Dr. Eberlein, and that's this concept of flexibility in surgical training and the traditional paradigm of either 5 years or five plus whatever numbers in the lab that somebody might do. First of all, how do you define flexibility in training? How do you look at it? How do you implement it? And most importantly, how do you get others to buy along with this concept when they don't believe in it?
Well, it's interesting. We embraced early specialization. You know, the American Board of Surgery a number of years ago permitted early specialization in thoracic surgery and in vascular surgery. And I believe our institution was the only one that embraced both. There were institutions that did one or the other, but not both. And what we learned from that is trainees who are highly motivated and want to do early specialization can actually fulfill the requirements for board certification of the American Board of General of American Board of Surgery, and then go on and become double boarded in cardiothoracic surgery or vascular surgery. And they could do that in less time of training. And so that got us into thinking that, goodness, especially with duty hour restrictions and other kinds of things, it really begs the idea that we should change the paradigm. And the paradigm, the old paradigm, the whole, sort of Halsteadian paradigm of training was observation and replication. And while that may be an inefficient way of training, it was very effective as long as you had the trainee stay in the hospital 120 hours a week. If we're going to have training programs where we limit hours, 80 hours or perhaps even less, then I think we've really got to change the entire paradigm, and that is we have to stick to a curriculum, and the curriculums have to be the same for whoever is training on a particular rotation. We have to do performance evaluations, which we're not usually very used to doing, and providing feedback to the trainee so that they know how they're doing and whether they're meeting, exceeding, or not meeting the expectations of their training paradigm. Introducing lots of simulation in virtual training. I always use the analogy of a pilot. We don't take a pilot and put him in the cockpit of a 747 full of people and say, gee, today you're going to learn how to fly an airplane. We do extensive training with simulation, anticipating the common and even not so common problems that can be encountered. And what if we were to have a similar kind of simulation, virtual training for virtually every kind of surgical intervention? We don't yet, but we're developing some of those training tools, and I think it would much better prepare our trainees. And if you stick to that kind of a paradigm, I think we can actually shorten the length of time that it takes to train. And so we've analyzed our trainees who have been in early specialization, and their performance on board examinations is actually higher than their colleagues who go through standard training paradigms. And they've gotten superb jobs. Virtually all of them are in academics. And so then we decided that might be a way of shortening training and making it more efficient. And in parallel, the American Board of Surgery announced a change that allowed residents, during their training the last 3 years, you could spend up to 1 year in a focused area of training. So let's pick on minimal invasive surgery. You're interested in doing minimal invasive surgery. You could actually spend up to 12 months in the last 3 years of your training solely on minimal invasive surgery. And so we actually piloted that at our institution and found that it was highly supported by our trainees. As you can imagine, that it allowed each trainee to begin to tailor the training that they felt would be best for the type of practice that they wanted to have when they finished their training. And that was the night has been for us to go back to the board and say, well, it works for us, but how might it work for other institutions? And so we got 8 other institutions, all superb institutions and all with very dedicated training programs, to agree to pilot early flexibility, and with the idea that we would collate all the information from flexible training trainees as well as non-flexible, so that we could compare performance on evaluation, performance on in-training scores, and eventually on board scores for the cohort that's going through in this pilot project. And so that became a work under the direction of Mary Klingensmith, and I'm happy to report it seems to be going quite well. The one a logistical issue is that if, you know, in like in our program, the majority of our trainees are now in a flexible situation, but it requires that our program directors modify the schedules, and that becomes, it looks like a genetic heat map instead of a surgical schedule, where when I was training, everybody went through in a lockstep and the color was absolutely the same. And now everybody is doing different rotations at different times in order to accommodate this flexibility and individualization of training.
Well, you definitely make a strong case for the early specialization, sir. I guess the question I have, you mentioned one about the logistics, but what are some of the disadvantages of early specialization that you've noticed or possible ones that you foresee?
Well, I think that one obvious issue is that people say, well, it works well for somebody who wants to specialize. So I want to specialize in minimal invasive surgery or foregut, or I want to specialize in bariatric, or I want to specialize in colorectal surgery, etc. That might work well because I'm looking to confine my practice in an area. But what happens if we want to go out to rural someplace in rural America and practice broad general surgery? And my response to that is that we should actually train people in a similar flexible way, but in broad general surgery, and not only doing, you know, trauma and vascular and GYN and orthopedic and other kinds of things that you're likely to encounter if you're going to be in rural Wyoming or some other rural place in America. And we sort of do that a little bit with our ACCS kinds of paradigms, but even there, it's not quite the same as with concerted effort of, gee, what is it going to take for you to be a successful general surgeon where you may be the only general surgeon for a couple hundred mile radius, and therefore you're going to be called upon to take care of a wide range of issues that you wouldn't necessarily be exposed to as a specialist. And in our program, it's actually worked quite well for our ACCS folks, because what we've done is taken people who have finished a fellowship and actually appointed them an instructor and allowed them more autonomy, but in a very controlled setting. So they're not thrown in to a call schedule and expected to take care of every serious issue that comes down the pike, but only the things that they feel comfortable with. And there's no stigma to their calling somebody more senior to help them with the more complex and or rare issue. And by the way, that's another thing that just recently the American Board of Surgery has said, that trainees could become board eligible after 4 years of training. And so again, you could very easily envision where flexibility could evolve into allowing people to specialize earlier, and that would allow them to become board eligible earlier in their training paradigm. And you'd almost eliminate the need for a fellowship, because you just keep training, but with more and more and more autonomy. And it may be one of the ways to get around the issue of the high cost of surgical training and the long number of years, and but it would be a change in paradigm. But that would allow more autonomy in the later years of training, because you'd be board eligible. You could bill for the more simple things. Using my paradigm, for example, in minimal invasive surgery, you see a patient with a relatively straightforward appendectomy or appendicitis, and you felt comfortable doing the appendectomy, well, then you would be able to take care of the patient and bill for the patient. On the other hand, if it was a much more complex situation, perhaps a patient who had had an MI and was on an LVAD and had other comorbidities and now had right upper quadrant pain and acute cholecystitis, well, that might be a case where you'd want somebody a little more senior to help you with that case. And so you could very easily envision that you'd get graded autonomy, but there would be no stigmata like most of them probably have felt when we first joined a staff or a faculty, and you were presented with a really tough case, and could you or should you call for more senior help, and what is the stigma that is associated with it?
Great, sir. This is Kevin, and just kind of touch a little bit further on the flexibility in training. Let's, in a hypothetical situation, a very hypothetical situation, as Dr. Steele will attest to, let's say this March I find out that I match at Wash U for general surgery residency coming up the next year. How in practicality does this work for you guys right now with flexible training? And then how do you foresee it being in 10 years? So like on the first day they show up, you know, June 10th or something, do you guys sit down with them and try and figure out their career plans at that point, or is it more halfway through the residency then you focus on the flexibility and they still have the sort of set in stone?
Kevin, I think it's a continuous process. As you can imagine, somebody shows up day one and says, gee, I'm interested in minimal invasive surgery, or gee, I'm interested in colorectal surgery or whatever it might be. 40% or 50% of our trainees, like national average, change their mind at some point in time. One of the things that I think is good about our program is that we have very, very strong disciplines. And so if you want to do vascular, you want to do colorectal or thoracic or oncology or HPB, they all happen to be very strong programs. And so changing one's mind is not usually done with a penalty. I think the other thing that happens is there's continuous mentoring, so that as the trainee is going through various rotations, particularly in the junior years, they're given the opportunity to declare, if they wish, some area of flexible training that they would like to pursue. And so, for example, this year we're just starting transplant flexible training. It's the first, and we're hoping that we can actually talk the colorectal Society of Colorectal Surgery and the American Board of Colorectal Surgery into doing the same thing. We'd love to pilot that at our institution also. So I think that, again, it's an ongoing iterative process. And likewise, there are trainees even in our institution who choose not to do flexibility, and that's okay. There should be no stigma associated with that, with either of those choices.
So, sir, you trained in a different time and at some of the most prestigious places in the world. You've lived through the 80-hour work week, and everybody has different thoughts on that, and now you are obviously the chairman of the department. What is the future general surgeon going to look like? And do you believe the 80-hour work week had a significant impact on kind of this entire process? And without the 80-hour work week, do you think this would have come into its own? Would we have found our way here anyway without it?
Well, I do think we would have found our way to a different paradigm. You know, think about what has happened in my lifetime as a surgeon. So when I finished my training, we were doing open surgery. We're doing open vascular surgery. Laparoscopic surgery hadn't started. And think of what has happened over the literally my career as a surgeon. Gastric surgery is almost non-existent. Intervention for common bowel duct disease, unless it's a tumor, is almost always non-surgical. Portal hypertension, which was oftentimes very, very difficult intervention surgically, is now handled almost all by a non-invasive or an invasive but non-surgical technique. Look what's happened to much of GI surgery. As many of you, Scott, your perfect example, colorectal surgery, and you're doing it minimally invasively with less morbidity and better outcomes. And of course, look at the vascular surgery. The entire field has been turned on its ear. And so, again, that bespeaks that we have to change the paradigm of how we train people, because I can't observe you doing an endovascular procedure and expect that I'm going to be able to do it as well by simple observation. It's going to require us investing in technologies that allow me to train in a virtual way or with simulation to be able to practice and develop the techniques that are going to make me a successful surgeon. So the surgeon of the future is really going to be somebody who does these highly technical interventions, but also is going to have to be skilled at doing open procedures, because there are going to be some things, and trauma, blunt trauma is probably one example where minimal invasive technology is not necessarily going to bail us out all the time. And so, right now we're in this sort of transition phase, but I think it's really exciting. And I think, yes, 80-hour work week probably got us to focus and say, gee, are we going to be able to leave everything, the paradigm, the same, or are we going to try to change the paradigm? And but I think the technology is even a bigger issue that has forced everyone's hand into a different kind of training paradigm.
Well, I definitely sense some optimism there, which is good for Kevin and I, who are both still residents. So, our future as a general surgeon is still somewhat secure. But
I think it's an incredibly exciting time, and I think, in fact, I say to our trainees that I think this actually is the golden time to be a surgeon. And think about the science, you know, genomics, imaging, vaccines, other kinds of technologies. They're going to play a role. I mean, our cancer center is developing goggles. These are using infrared laser and technology where you can inject a dye into tumors, and you can actually see microscopic disease using these goggles. Now, that's been the big bugaboo of all of us who do cancer resections. How much is enough? Do you need to increase the morbidity by doing a wider dissection? Or do you risk recurrence if you do a less morbid dissection? Well, now, we're developing the technology where I think we're probably going to be able to enhance how a surgeon does a resection. And what's neat about it is I could sit here in St. Louis and look on the computer screen and tell you, Kevin, in Seattle, whether or not you're removing enough tissue. So as a trainee or as a person who practices in an underserved or international environment, that may be particularly important. And so it's really pretty pretty neat technology. So I think this is the golden time for being a trainee in general surgery.
Well, it's definitely exciting, sir. Now that we're going to transition to our tips and tricks segment, and this is where we ask our experts a specific scenario to walk us through, you know, just give us the pearls and pitfalls that you may have. For you, Dr. Eberlein, we're going to talk about axillary dissection, and specifically, we have a wide range of, you know, medical students to attendings that listen to this podcast, but if you could walk us through how to find the nerves and maybe keys to get to the uppermost level of nodes, specifically, you know, the difficult level 2 or the level 1 nodes in some cases.
Sure. I think that, you know, we do fewer axillary dissections, but I have to say there are indications in both in melanoma and in breast cancer, of course, and I always try to first identify the boundaries, and so pectoral muscle medially and latissimus muscle laterally, and if I'm doing a dissection where it's not a mastectomy, but it's a axillary dissection through an axillary incision, I always try to maintain all of the subcutaneous fat. As I point out to the trainees, there are no lymph nodes, of course, in the subcutaneous. And so it's usually pretty easy to find a plane that get you closer to the lymph nodes but leave the subcutaneous fat, and I think that will enhance the cosmesis. You're not going to have a big scalloped out axillary dissection area postoperatively. And I also believe that reduces the amount of postoperative fluid egress from the axilla. Then I go up and identify the axillary vein, and again, another important aspect is to spare all of the fat around the axillary vein. I think that's really important because if you think about it, a lot of lymphatics run along the axillary vessel, and when I was trained to do axillary dissections, we skeletonized the vein. I mean, it would look like a Frank Netter diagram. And the other thing is that you can see intercostal brachial nerves better that way. So as you're beginning to sweep the axillary contents inferior, you can identify those intercostal brachial nerves. And it's something that I try to pay attention to in my dissection and spare those nerves. It takes a lot of extra time, as it were. You have to be patient in dissecting them out, medial to lateral, lateral to medial. But of all the things you do in an axillary dissection, that's probably one thing that a patient will appreciate most, because she won't have numbness and pain and tingling and swelling. And then the next step is I identify the thoracodorsal vessels and nerve. And you go lateral to medial, so you're sweeping the axillary contents medial. You identify the thoracodorsal vessels and nerve, and there is a perforator of the thoracodorsal vein that enters the chest wall, and it's right at that point that you can find the long thoracic nerve. It's very interesting. I love asking our trainees how they find the axillary or to the long thoracic nerve, and everybody talks about it being up against the chest wall and so on. But if you think about it, if you go lateral to medial, the thoracodorsal nerve is in your vision, so you can see that very easily, so you can't mistake the two nerves. And then if you look for this little vessel perforating into the chest wall, you'll see the nerve right there, and the long thoracic, and it's there 100% of the time, as they say to our trainees, 99.9%. And so it's very easy then to take the long thoracic nerve and dissect it out. And there you could even do that in many cases semi-bluntly, as it were. And then you go back and remove now all of the axillary contents or medial, and you see both nerves they're in front of you, and you can then remove the rest of the axillary contents. And I always divide the inferior tissue around the tail of the breast, etc. I don't just use cautery or just cut it freely. Because again, I believe that that minimizes the amount of post-operative drainage in your drain, and so it's actually a pretty safe way to do an axillary dissection, and I would say, except for educational purposes, I occasionally will take a forceps and just very lightly tweak one of the motor nerves, but otherwise I routinely do not pinch the motor nerves, because I always make the point that that obviously might damage the nerve in a way, and also you might have some tingling and other that is residual. So it's a way of doing the dissection safely. You identify the motor nerves visually, and it's a way of not relying on stimulating the motor nerves, and you can also preserve the intercostal brachial nerves. And I usually am able to preserve at least two or three intercostal brachial nerves.
Okay, that ends our tips and tricks, and now it's time for our final five. This is where we ask our guests to tell us a little bit about themselves. Number one, sir, do you listen to music in the operating room? And if so, what do you listen to?
I do listen to music. It's interesting that I'm the only surgeon on our faculty that has no block time, so I tend to be in everybody else's room. And so I'm always envious of my minimal invasive and endovascular colleagues that tend to have great stereo systems. But I love symphony music and jazz, something light in the background, not something real loud, so that we can still communicate between the various members of the team.
Great. Number two, sir, do you have any hobbies, talents, or interests outside of the operating room?
Well, I have a lot of interests. I don't know that I would necessarily say talent. I love playing golf. I have a group that I play with regularly. Will Chapman, who's our head of general surgery and transplant surgery, is one of those, as is Jerry Andrio, who's the chief of urology. And I play with a group on a regular basis. We actually take some golf trips together. It's a little bit like psycho golf. I don't know. I wouldn't go so far as to say I have a lot of talent, but I love doing it. And then I love reading, and I read an eclectic amount of literature, but particularly biographies and historical kinds of things that I think can inform us so that we don't repeat history.
Sir, I have to ask, when we interviewed Dr. John Cameron from Johns Hopkins, he's very big into golf. I was wondering, have you played with him at all?
As a matter of fact, I have. And John would probably never tell you this, but, you know, John has one of the most unique swings. It almost looks like he has a baseball bat. And yet, I don't think he has ever hit a golf ball that it isn't within about 3 inches of the center of the fairway. Now, of course, all of you would recognize that a golf ball like a trainee or a junior faculty would never, ever be more than 3 inches beyond the midline, you see, so in anything that involved John. So golf ball is no exception.
All right, question number three. Is there a favorite trip or vacation you've taken recently?
Oh, yeah, as a matter of fact, I you know, I'm the first tee of any golf course is a vacation for me, and I've been to Edinburgh, Scotland, and one of these days I hope to play the old course. But I've actually gotten to play a number of very, very beautiful courses around the globe, and it's you know, those beautiful venues are nice. I think my wife loves Hawaii. If she could pick any place that she would like to go, that'd probably be it.
But we did have Chambers Bay, the home of the U.S. Open, right about 20 minutes away from us. It's a beautiful course itself. Number four, sir, if you had not gone into medicine, what career field do you think you'd be in?
I've always said that my Walter Mitty is being the conductor of a symphony orchestra. And if you think about it, what we do as surgeons is almost the same. You take this team of individuals, an anesthesiologist and a nurse and a circulator and a scrub tech and so on, and individually they're not necessarily able to do an operation, but as a team, it's a symphony. And the music director of the St. Louis Symphony is a good friend, and he oftentimes makes that point that you know, it's really the blend of all of the experts together that really make an operation go very, very well.
So, definitely a good analogy.
That's what I'd probably do if I weren't a surgeon.
All right, perfect. Question number five and our last question. If you go back in time and see yourself on the first day of internship, what advice would you give yourself?
Well... I think probably all of us remember that. The advice I would give is give it some time and realize, trust yourself. In my case, the person who had signed out to me, he didn't actually sign out. He just handed me his beeper and said, gee, everybody will be out of the operating room in a minute, and they'll make rounds with you. And so I proudly put this beeper on my belt, and within about a jilly second, this person evaporated, and the beeper went off, and it was the chairman of medicine's sister who had had a total pancreatectomy the day before and had a blood glucose of 25 and no IV access and was seizing. And that was my first page.
Well, sir, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Behind the Knife. We recognize how busy your scheduling is, and to give us an hour of your time has just been fantastic. And I know I speak for both Kevin and John and Jason, who couldn't make it with us, that we're very appreciative for that, and we look forward to future discussions. And once again, thank you for all the help that you've had with our podcast, and especially with regards to the journal and the website and everything. So thank you very much.
Well, Scott, Kevin, and John, thanks very much. You make it very easy, and I hope that it'll be what you expected when you get done with all your editing and what have you. So, but, and Scott, always good to talk to you.
Well, that does it for us today at Behind the Knife. We have a lot of things in the works in the next few weeks and putting together a bunch of combination episodes. But before we go, here's your random fact of the day.
So, John, it's been a little while since we've done a random fact of the day. I thought it was about time we brought it back. And this time I wanted to talk about Lewis and Clark.
Yeah, so in their expedition, 8,000 miles across the United States to explore the land acquired in 1883 by the Louisiana Purchase, only one person died during the entire trek, which was approximately 50 people.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. His name was actually Sergeant Charles Floyd. He was a healthy soldier who joined the adventure. And partway through the adventure in 1804, he developed lower abdominal pain and had some vomiting. Clark, who had had some medical training, diagnosed him with bilious colic. Ended up that this was the incorrect diagnosis, and Sergeant Charles Floyd actually succumbed to appendicitis and died. And he's actually buried in Sioux City, Iowa, with a 100-foot commemorative obelisk resembling the monument to George Washington.
It is pretty impressive that they made that entire trip and only one person died the entire way.
2 years, 8,000 miles in the beginning of the 19th century, and appendicitis was the only death.
And that has been your random fact of the day.
Until next time, dominate the day.